Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hobrock. First on this week's program, yes, Phoenix is sinking. What does that mean for the city? This story was written by TJ LeHeroux and was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on May 15th. It's official. The Valley of the Sun is sinking, according to a research study. But don't go panicking yet. Almost all major cities in the United States are sagging, and Phoenix isn't among the fastest sinking. The city is sinking by an average of less than a millimeter per year, 0.85 millimeters to be more precise. It's worse in some areas than in others. A map included in the study, which was published by Nature Cities, shows that while most of Phoenix isn't sinking, the west side is dropping by about 3 millimeters every year. The Pinnacle Peak area that borders Scottsdale is sinking by at least 5 millimeters per year. Out of the 28 largest cities in the country, Phoenix is in the middle of the pack. It has the 18th highest rate of subsidence, which is a fancy word for sinking. The cities that are sinking the fastest are in Texas, Houston, more than 5 millimeters a year, and Dallas and Fort Worth, both around 4 millimeters. New York, 2.4, and Chicago, 2.3, also have high subsidence rates. The study's researchers estimated that at least 20% of the urban area is sinking in all cities, mainly due to groundwater extraction, affecting about 34 million people. They used space geodetic measurements from 2015 to 2021 to calculate the annual sinking rates. Groundwater extraction played a huge role in causing Phoenix to sink during its urban boom in the late 20th century. Over a 40-year period, starting in the 1950s, Phoenix sank a whopping 18 feet, almost half a foot every year. Today's millimeter-a-year sinkage isn't so bad comparatively. That's because in 1980, Arizona passed the Groundwater Management Act, implementing reforms for water conservation, minimizing how much water valley cities pump from the ground, and restocking underground reservoirs. Still, Phoenix should be wary of its sinking status. A little can have a big effect, the study noted. Even modest rates of urban subsidence can profoundly impact the structural integrity of buildings, roads, bridges, and dams, researchers wrote. Over time, these incremental changes may accumulate, magnifying vulnerabilities within urban systems, notably exacerbating existing flood risks with impacts on urban livability. Compared to other cities, Phoenix's infrastructure isn't terribly threatened. Only 172 buildings are at risk, and none are at high risk of crumbling, according to the study. Compared to the more than 10,000 buildings at risk or high risk in Dallas, and almost 4,000 in Houston, that isn't so bad. Still, the researchers don't think things are likely to improve anytime soon. The anthropogenic drivers of subsidence, including groundwater extraction and the loading effect of urban development, are likely to intensify as cities continue to grow and climate change exacerbates environmental stresses, the study noted. So, next time you get that sinking feeling, take heart. It's just the city crumbling under your feet, very, very slowly. Next, a story written by TJ LeHeroux and posted on May 13th. New Phoenix monsoon season forecast released. What to expect? With summer just around the corner, it's time to brace for the scorching heat season in Phoenix. But that's not all to expect. It looks like the valley might be in for a good monsoon season this year. The odds are tilted toward this summer being warmer and wetter than normal in the Phoenix metropolitan area. Mark O'Malley, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service, told Phoenix New Times in a phone interview. Monsoon season, by definition, is a reversal of weather patterns. In the winter, jet streams carry rain west to east from the Pacific Ocean into Arizona. But during the summer, the storms come from the south and west, typically establishing a high-pressure area over the Four Corners region that brings lots of rain. Phoenix's monsoon season runs from June 15th to September 30th, according to the NWS, and O'Malley said Phoenix's baseline is 2.7 inches of precipitation. The current NWS forecast for July to September shows that Phoenix has a 40% chance of a wetter than normal summer and a 27% chance of summer being drier than usual. The odds this year are a lot better than what we've seen in the past couple years, O'Malley said, of increased precipitation. That will likely benefit Arizona and potentially breathe some life into the Sonoran Desert, which is the most biologically diverse desert in the United States. For that, Arizona can thank a recent blocking pattern, O'Malley said. A blocking pattern means weather isn't moving as fast across land and becomes stagnant. That's been fairly frequent in the past couple of months, and that will probably continue in some form over the summer, O'Malley said. Arizona is at the center of a southwestern area of the United States that the NWS predicts will experience more rainfall than normal this summer. The eastern coast and southern states like Alabama, Louisiana, and Mississippi are also set to experience wetter than normal summers. But much of the United States, like the Midwest and Great Plains states, are likely to have drier than usual summers. Wetter doesn't mean cooler, though. There's a 46% chance that the summer in Phoenix will be warmer than normal, considering the last two summers both saw record-setting temperatures. That's no surprise. Yet, NWS meteorologist Ryan Worley told New Times last month that this summer might not smash records again. Statistically speaking, it doesn't seem like we're going to be looking at temperatures exceeding or reaching those levels for a third time, Worley said. Is it completely out of the question? Absolutely not. Tempe drops charge against man it cited for feeding the homeless. This next story was written by T.J. LeHeru and was posted on May 13th. The city of Tempe has dropped a criminal charge it brought against a local activist for feeding unhoused people in a city park without a permit. A surprising about-face after more than a year of ramped-up enforcement that targeted advocates for the homeless. The activist in question is Ron Tapscott, whom the city charged in January with a violation of its special permits ordinance. The 77-year-old Tapscott had been hosting feedings for unhoused people in city parks under the banner of his organization, New Deal Meal. At a scheduling hearing Monday, Tapscott and others learned that the city prosecutor, Alan Witt, would dismiss the charges without prejudice, meaning that they could be refiled at a later date. Witt filed a motion to dismiss the case without prejudice on May 7th, writing simply that he was dropping the case in the interest of justice. Tempe Municipal Court Judge Kevin Kane approved the motion on Friday. The reversal caught Tapscott and his attorney off guard. "It was definitely a surprise," said Christina Q. Carter, who represents Tapscott, after the scheduled hearing. "I came prepared to argue the points of our pleadings today, but the city prosecutor let me know that he filed a motion to dismiss on Friday." Witt did not respond to a request for comment or reply to a question about whether it was his decision to drop the case, but Tempe spokesperson Crix Baxter Ging said it was. "The decision was made by the prosecutors handling the case," Baxter Ging told New Times. she did not respond to a question about whether the dismissal marks a change in strategy for the city. It certainly hasn't been the city's strategy to this point. Tempe spent more than a year trying to coerce its residents to stop feeding unhoused people in city parks. The city's first target was poet and advocate Austin Davis, who was hosting Sunday picnics in Tempe parks to provide unhoused people with food and connect them to detox and housing programs. The city's park rangers and police force persistently hounded Davis, and the city slapped him with dozens of special permit violations, triggering a court battle that later settled. Witt was the prosecutor in that case, too. In the interim, the city arrested Davis for trespassing in city parks, jailing him overnight twice. With Davis unable to run the feedings, community members like Tapscott stepped up to run them in his stead. They tried using a legal loophole, casting New Deal Meal as a club, therefore making it a private event. The city still hit Tapscott with a violation and issued a warning to Reverend Dr. Tom Martinez. Then the police stopped issuing citations and warnings, only watching from afar in unmarked vehicles. Given that, this isn't how Tapscott figured things would go. "It's a bit of a surprise," Tapscott said, "particularly given the history of the city being vindictive and angry about people trying to help others." A long history. The permit violation was hardly the first time Tapscott and Tempe have been at odds. He has a notable history of political activism in the city. Tapscott and his organization, Tempe First, rallied against a proposed arena deal for the Arizona Coyotes, which Tempe voters ultimately rejected in 2023. That earned Tapscott the scorn of city leaders, who were caught on tape comparing him to a crazy uncle in a secret meeting held on December 15, 2022. The contents of that tape were revealed because that meeting violated open meetings law, meaning any material from it is public record. A staffer recorded the meeting, and in January, New Times obtained the tape. Tapscott suspects that saga had something to do with the city's decision to prosecute him. "It's about corruption, and I think that they were upset with me about making the corruption from the Coyotes deal and other development clear and irrefutable," he said. "I think they decided to take it out on this particular issue, and I think they decided to back off when they knew that further exposure about their corruption was not going to go away." There was also a lawsuit that put Tempe on the defensive. In April, Tapscott, Davis, and June Parker of HOPE Arizona joined forces with public interest law firm Pacific Legal Foundation to sue the city in federal court. They argue that the city's special events ordinance does not apply to the meals, and that its enforcement violates their freedom of speech. Tempe City Manager Rosa Inkowski is named as a defendant in the suit. As a result of the suit, which is still pending, Tapscott thinks city leaders may be reevaluating how wise it is to cite and jail people for trying to help the homeless. "I think it moved from being just a political issue for them to being an issue where they have lost their moral direction and compass," he said. After Tapscott and others heard of the city's dismissal, he and about 20 other people associated with New Deal Meal mingled on the second floor of Tempe Municipal Court. As they bunched together to take a picture, Davis walked in and was beckoned into the huddle. The saga started with him, and he happily joined the celebration. "What happened today in court is a testament to the strength and resilience of the neighbors of Tempe who have worked together for months to continue fighting to protect the basic human rights of the most vulnerable in their community," Davis said. "Because of how our community has worked together to document and film the city's targeted harassment, the case against Ron had no legs to stand on." Next, a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on May 14th. Health versus Wealth. Arizona groups coordinate to save Medicaid from GOP. Last Tuesday, hundreds of postcards arrived at the home of Janie Pearl Starks. The community impact officer for Mountain Park Health Center, Starks had spent the previous week driving to the center's 11 community health clinics throughout the valley to pass the cards around. Like boomerangs, she'd expected their returns. The postcards were not addressed to her, but to Republican Representative David Schweikert. The conservative congressman is one of several Arizonans in the House of Representatives set to vote on a recent Republican budget proposal that would slash $880 billion from the health care safety net. The cuts would specifically target Medicaid, which provides health care coverage to more than 2 million low-income Arizonans. Starks and others are leading an effort to stop that from happening. Mountain Park centers serve more than 115,000 underserved Valley patients, a population that would be most impacted by Medicaid cuts. At each of Mountain Park's locations, clinic captains have informed patients of the proposed cuts and explained how their own health care would be impacted. The clinic workers have then asked patients to sign a postcard, which urges Schweikert to protect Medicaid and recognize its vital role in Arizona, which will then be delivered to the congressman's district office. In just the last weeks, Starks and her Mountain Park staffers have collected more than 715 postcards. "It's super grassroots," Starks told Phoenix New Times on Tuesday, "but we have to do something." Starks outlined her project Tuesday at a roundtable discussion of more than a dozen healthcare-related advocacy groups. Hosted by the nonprofit Latino organization Unidos US at a neighborhood outreach access to health clinic in South Scottsdale, the event was more working group than a media event. Only a few reporters attended, and even fewer community members. "More than anything, it felt like a crisis meeting, a chance for a gaggle of advocacy groups to organize, strategize, and brace for the fight against the GOP budget proposal." Staffers from the offices of Representative Greg Stanton and Senators Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego, all Democrats, also attended. The groups said that they extended an invitation to Schweikert's office, but no staffer of his attended. A representative for Schweikert did not immediately respond to a request for comment. "If you look around the room at the stakeholders that are sitting here and the networks that they're associated with, there's a great deal of power and influence in this room," said Eric Rodriguez, the vice president of Unidos US. "How do we drive that toward more collective action on these issues?" Real harm. The roundtable participants had little trouble defining the problem. The Republican budget proposal's $880 billion in cuts to Medicaid would help cover the cost of $4.5 trillion in tax breaks, many of which would benefit the richest of Americans and corporations. Democrats and healthcare advocates have warned that the cuts could cost an estimated 8.6 million Americans their health coverage. Without it, those Americans could lose access to essential services like routine checkups, pregnancy and childbirth care, vital surgeries, and cancer treatments. Without Medicaid, or with a less robust version of it, the out-of-pocket costs for such care would go up, forcing families to make tough financial decisions to fill the gaps. That harm would affect more than just individual patients and families. It's likely to weaken the country's entire healthcare system. Rural hospitals could face closures, depriving communities of access to doctors. When medical bills go up for a large swath of Americans, the economy feels the strain. "When coverage goes away, people still need healthcare," said Jessica Yanow, the president and CEO of the Arizona Alliance for Community Health Centers. "So there's still costs associated with that." At the Tuesday roundtable, Joseph Garcia of Chicanos Por La Causa called the proposal a simple case of health versus wealth. This is really punishing our most vulnerable communities, families, and children who are in dire need of health care in order to justify tax breaks for the wealthiest of our nation, said Garcia, who is the vice president of public policy for the group. This should not be up for debate. It's real harm. The question is, what's to be done? 2 months ago, Kelly and Gallego hosted a town hall in the same room about the potential Republican plan to cut Medicaid. There, an attendee told them about potentially losing the ability to pay for treatment of one of her kids, whose rare form of diabetes is covered by Medicaid. I'm 100% going to take that back to my Republican colleagues, Kelly told her. It doesn't seem that Kelly's colleagues listened. On Sunday, House Republicans released a formal budget that formalized cuts to Medicaid. That spurred advocacy groups into action, leading to Tuesday's roundtable. At the event, the newly formed coalition shared ideas, strategies, and next steps for targeting two vulnerable Republican representatives, Schweikert and Juan Ciscomani. Both serve in districts that are considered competitive in the 2026 midterms, potentially making them more scared of pissed-off constituents than they would be of bucking Donald Trump. Ciscomani has already spoken out against Medicaid cuts, but Schweikert, who has faced protests outside of his district office, hasn't been as bold. But if activists turn one, Garcia said, more may follow. It's only going to take a few Republicans to say no and fight this. But you don't want that narrow of a margin, Garcia said. It's strength in numbers. A few more will say no, and a few more will join in. They need to know that they're not safe. That's politics. Going on the offensive. How do they do that? Jennifer Longden, a former state representative and the chief external affairs officer for AACHC, said that it basically requires being a real pain in the ass. It doesn't take a whole lot to shut down a congressional office's phone line, she said, apologizing to the staffers of the elected officials in the room. Call the other offices, cracked Abigail O'Brien, who is the state director for Gallego. Longden called this moment an opportunity to flex, urging organizers to blow up phone lines, write letters, clog email boxes, flood social media accounts, attend community events, and, of course, protest. The whole nine yards. There is enough collective power across Arizona and the nation to make them see the natural consequences of voting against the well-being of the constituents that they serve, Longden said. Of course, that will take more than the organizers at the Tuesday discussion. To effectively push back against the proposed cuts, advocacy groups must recast the cuts from being just cruel, which should be enough, to also being wildly unpopular, said Monica Schanschaffer, the Arizona director for Mi Familia Vota. The more that we can connect with this kind of proposal and with people's real lives, the less popular it's going to be. Many Americans are tired of politics, Garcia said, and many may not be interested in engaging in overtly political actions. That means organizers must explain that this is not politics, this is public health, he said. This is your friends, your neighbors, family members, colleagues, co-workers, perhaps even yourself. Organizers have some time. The Republican proposal still needs to make it through both the House and the Senate. But that time is not infinite. It will take a concerted and sustained effort to place lawmakers like Schweikert and Ciscomani on the fence and then tip them over the other side. The calls, emails, and yes postcards need to start hitting fast and furious. We're not going to change the administration's mind on just about anything, Rodriguez said. But Congress is the one thing that has to pay the price come next November. So that's our opportunity for influence. It's on us to hold them accountable. Horn surprised by anti-trans bill vetoes that happen every year. This next story was written by Zach Buchanan and was posted on May 14th. What's it they say about the definition of insanity? Doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result? Might be time for Arizona Schools Chief Tom Horn to get checked out. On Monday, Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs vetoed two bills from Republican State Senator John Kavanaugh that targeted transgender kids. One, Senate Bill 1002, would have required teachers and school staff to use only the names assigned to students at birth and the pronouns that correspond with their biological sex. The other, Senate Bill 1003, would have barred transgender students from using the bathrooms, locker rooms, and showers that correspond with their gender identities. This bill will not increase opportunity, security, or freedom for Arizonans, Bill wrote in her veto letter for each. Both bills are right-wing culture war bills that attack largely non-existent issues and create issues of their own. Though Kavanaugh and Horn have cast the bathroom bill as an effort to protect girls, there are few examples of girls being at any real risk because a transgender student uses the same bathroom. And, as Save Our Schools Executive Director Beth Lewis pointed out last year, no students really shower at school these days. The pronoun bill, which requires schools to notify parents if students start going by different pronouns, would out transgender students to trans-hostile parents, who might then put their child's safety at risk. As the bill numbers suggest, Kavanaugh raced to file them the second the legislative session opened. And indeed, he has filed essentially identical bills each of the previous 2 years. And each of the previous 2 years, Hobbs has vetoed them. In his own curdled rhetoric after the vetoes, Kavanaugh acknowledged that history. Governor Hobbs continues to push gender neutrality as a way to win votes from her extremist liberal community at the expense of exposing vulnerable children to sexual violence, harassment, and emotional distress, he wrote. Yet Horn, who has pushed the anti-trans agenda just as hard as Kavanaugh, seems to have been caught off guard. It's surprising to me that the governor did not recognize the legislation's value in promoting common sense, girls' privacy, safety, and the rights of parents to be fully informed about what their children are doing while at school or related activities, wrote the state superintendent of public instruction in a press release. When asked the reason for Horn's surprise, Department of Education spokesperson Doug Nick emailed the above quote from Horn's release, adding that it's still an issue of parents' rights and the safety of school-aged girls. After the story was first published, Nick responded to a follow-up question about why Hobbs' continued opposition should at all be surprising. After quoting the story's first two paragraphs about the definition of insanity, Nick added, "Feel free to apply that same standard to vetoing the same legislation over and over again. I'll wait." That response does hit upon a certain truth. After all, just as July follows June every year, Hobbs strikes down Kavanaugh's anti-trans bills. Maybe when it happens again next year, Horn won't be so surprised. Remember that if you missed any of the stories in this program or any other Sun Sounds program, you can listen to them on demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then click on Demand Podcasts, scroll down to the program you're interested in, and click on Listen. Here's a story written by Sam Eifling and posted on May 15th. We got a $123,000 investigative reporting grant. Here's how we'll use it. In the days after taking the job as editor-in-chief of Phoenix New Times, I reached out to reporters in Phoenix and elsewhere in Arizona. It was clear to me that many of the Trump administration's stated aims were about to land hard on this state. In policing, on the border, in immigration policy, and in the fundamental workings of democracy. Our paper has a small staff. I knew I'd need freelancers to step up and meet the moment. In short, I'm concerned about how the incoming administration, which takes over the country 5 days from now, will affect Arizona. I wrote to one such freelancer, Bo Hodai, who specializes in writing about security. I want to make our coverage of the Trump administration's policy effects in Arizona a major priority. Often in this business, the real work of editing, so-called, is finding the people and the means to produce the journalism you want to see. It's a privilege today to share with New Times readers that we have made a significant score on both fronts. Starting this week, we are using a generous $123,000 reporting grant from the Trace Foundation, administered with the help of Deep South Today, to support a year of work by two longtime investigative reporters. Stephen Lemons, a former New Times staff writer and prolific freelance reporter, will contribute stories from Phoenix. And yes, Bo Hodai, a fiercely independent and scrupulous reporter, will report from Arizona's borderlands. His stories will run jointly on his Substack, Cochise Regional News, named for his home county. Between them, they've won awards from the Society of Professional Journalists and grants from the Fund for Investigative Journalism, among other honors. We needed something to call this venture. We settled on the Arizona Watchdog Project. Its aim is to support the work of Arizona's strongest public accountability reporters, to cover the rapid, even radical changes afoot in the state. We'll do our best to tell you what's happening and why, who's behind it, and how much it's going to cost. We're also going to uncover who stands to gain and who stands to lose. We also decided to delay this announcement until we had something for you to read. To kick off the AZWP, New Times is proud to bring you a Bo Hodai scoop we're calling The Big Takeover. The first entry in what promises to be a series of essential reads, the story explores a cache of documents that reveal conversations among right-wing policy advisors who appear to have informed Trump's policing and immigration strategies. These documents, previously unknown to the public, show unnerving discussions about using deportations as a public relations spectacle and point toward a possible radical reordering of U.S. law enforcement to be carried out in the coming months. The group proposes uniting aspects of America's policing agencies and giving the president command of their operations. The proposed plan, which originated in a Project 2025 working group on border security, would put the president in charge of a massive nationwide policing machine. Ostensibly, that machine would be for finding and speeding the deportations of people who deserve to be deported. But the quirky thing about massive nationwide policing machines is you just never quite know where the darn things will stop, or if, in fact, they ever will. The price of fact-finding. I'm still new to this job, so when I ask for financial support for our work, donors are taking a leap of faith. They can do so confidently because of what previous generations of journalists have built for us here in Phoenix. This paper started 55 years ago as a platform to criticize the government waging endless war in Vietnam and shooting Kent State students who had the temerity to exercise their First Amendment right to protest. As it grew over the decades, New Times kept alive that fire. Its reporters have long hounded those who would leverage their power to harm or exploit Arizonans. By the early 2000s, New Times had expanded its footprint to such cities as Denver, Dallas, Miami, and Houston. Soon it reached further, acquiring the Village Voice chain and eventually morphing into today's voice media group. At every stage, in every market, the company has carried that same defiant investigative bent. The flag that Phoenix first flew in the 1970s still permeates the DNA of this place. New Times is, at heart, a confrontational lot. If we offend our readers along the way, we're going to do so with facts rather than with opinions. It's a slow path to hike. Uncovering facts takes more time and money than whipping up hot takes. Fuming on a podcast or parroting party doctrine on cable is cheaper and easier than spending months excavating records and winning the trust of sources. Media figures who traffic in propaganda and off-the-cuff bullshitting can flood the airways. Meanwhile, the outlets that grind out deeply researched reports need all the help we can get. As professionals, and hell, as Americans, we remain committed to providing you, the reader, with real reporting. Our approach is harder, yes. It is also way more fun. I'm humbled when readers, advertisers, and funders still entrust Phoenix New Times with that mission. If you feel like joining the cause, we are always welcoming new members. Every dollar helps us continue to produce journalism that readers can access for free. But even if all you have to offer is your attention, we'll be happy to receive it. And in the coming months, I'm confident we'll reward you with more stories worth your time. Following up on the previous piece, here is a story written by Bo Hodai and posted on May 15th. The Big Takeover: The Secret Plans to Give Trump Command of America's Police. Since President Donald Trump's inauguration in January, his administration has ruthlessly prosecuted his promises of mass deportations. He has sent deportees to Guantanamo Bay and a terrorist prison in El Salvador. He has placed control of the southern border in the hands of the military. And despite promising to focus on hardened criminals, the administration has widened its immigrant dragnet by targeting documented and undocumented immigrants alike. Trump has done much of this in defiance of the judiciary, while claiming an amount of executive power previously unseen in American history. To the average American, this administration's approach may be reminiscent of an angry monkey hurling shit at a wall, but these anti-immigrant measures echo a plan that was meticulously crafted out of public view over at least the year preceding this Trump presidency. The purpose of that plan is to drastically restructure domestic law enforcement under the command of the president. The president would then have the machinery to target immigrants en masse and to crack down on those who oppose him. These plans and the identities of those who authored them have remained secret until now. Cochise Regional News and Phoenix New Times have obtained a trove of documents laying out these plans. While these documents have specific implications for border states such as Arizona and Texas, this plan is the fruit of a right-wing national security approach that sees the border as a 50-state problem. As such, the documents portend much wider consequences for the country at large. In coming months, CRN and New Times will deliver reporting that reveals the contents of these documents, their implications for the country, and their authors. This article is the first in that series of investigative reporting. This reporting is based on internal Project 2025 blueprints that lay out draft proposals for the Trump administration's immigration and law enforcement agenda. The documents contain several timelines for these actions, which are set to unfold throughout this year. Through the first 4 months of the Trump administration, the documents have repeatedly proven prophetic, leading us to believe that they are likely to continue to forecast Trump's moves. Meet the Border Security Work Group. Project 2025 was an effort by several far right-wing think tanks to craft a policy playbook for a second Trump presidency. Per materials we've obtained, the documents were created by a subgroup of the larger Project 2025 effort called the Border Security Workgroup. This subgroup, which until now was unknown to the American people, was tasked with crafting immigrant mass deportation plans, along with other law enforcement and national security policy. Though Trump repeatedly denied any involvement with Project 2025 during the election cycle, documents obtained by CRN and New Times strongly suggest that the group worked closely with Trump and his team, right through the election and up the White House steps. It is unclear whether the Project 2025 documents we have obtained constitute the group's final policy proposals, or whether Trump accepted these policies. It is clear, however, that many of the agenda items laid out in these documents have come to pass during the early months of this Trump presidency. We have also seen items that seem to have been crafted largely for propagandistic purposes come to pass. This has included the administration's demonization of some immigrant groups, particularly Venezuelans accused of being members of the gang Tren de Aragua, as terrorist threats. The administration has often deported these so-called terrorists on the basis of flimsy evidence and without due process. Internal Project 2025 documents obtained by CRN and New Times clearly state that targeting these alleged immigrant terrorists has been a vital part of a proposed communication strategy. The aim of that strategy, to galvanize political support for a broader plan to dramatically restructure and militarize law enforcement nationwide under the command of President Trump. Who put these plans together? Documents show that many of the authors have ties to Christian nationalists and other far-right extremists. Project 2025 and Trump. Project 2025 is an effort led by the Heritage Foundation, arguably America's most influential conservative think tank. The effort included input from a coalition of various right-wing public policy foundations and individual contributors. In April 2023, the group published a 922-page policy handbook titled 2025 Mandate for Leadership, Conservative Promise. In essence, the handbook sought to reshape the federal government under a second Trump administration around two pillars. The first is the once obscure unitary executive legal theory, which essentially consolidates unchecked executive power in the hands of the president. Critics argue the theory is unconstitutional and reframes the presidency as akin to a dictatorship or monarchy. The second pillar is hardline Christian fundamentalism. The Heritage Foundation was co-founded in 1973 by right-wing political luminary and Christian nationalist Paul Weyrich. According to the Project 2025 Border Security Workgroup materials, many involved in crafting these specific law enforcement and mass deportation plans have substantial ties to Christian nationalists, among other far-right extremists. The documents demonstrate that Project 2025 continued working well beyond the 2023 publication of the Mandate for Leadership tome to craft policy for a hoped-for second Trump presidency. While that work was occurring, then-candidate Trump repeatedly denied knowing anything about Project 2025. Critics responded by noting that publicly known contributors to the project had served in the first Trump presidential administration. Trump has since appointed several of those contributors to his current administration. Furthermore, documents we have obtained demonstrate that about a third of the individuals involved in crafting these specific Project 2025 law enforcement and mass deportation plans had also served in some capacity under the first Trump administration. The identities of most of the individuals involved in the Border Security Workgroup have not been previously revealed and will be explored at length later in this investigative series. According to megadata associated with the documents, they were crafted between May and September 2024, all while Trump was denying any involvement with Project 2025. The authors of these documents expected to work in tandem with the campaign and subsequent administration. They specifically discuss intentions to receive guidance and input from the presidential candidate and other key members of the executive team during the campaign, presidential transition period, and well into the first year of this administration. It's not clear from these documents whether the Border Security Workgroup policy proposals found purchase with Trump. But if there has been coordination between the administration and the authors, it would hardly be surprising Trump has already implemented several of the policy proposals contained in the documents. These have included the widespread revocation of immigrant parole programs and the revocation of status for many immigrants who are in the United States legally. The administration has sent immigrants to Guantanamo Bay and placed control of the U.S.-Mexico border in the hands of the military. And Trump has directed the Internal Revenue Service to help identify immigrants for deportation, breaking with long-held federal norms and clearly embracing the Border Security Workgroup's draconian recommendations. More disturbing, however, are those items the administration has not fully fleshed out yet. Domestic law enforcement realignment and militarization. After 9/11, aspects of all levels of American law enforcement were integrated for the purpose of finding terrorists. Over time, that infrastructure was applied to a more inclusive all-hazards detection and mitigation objective. This has had civil liberties consequences. For example, local police now sometimes assist federal authorities in monitoring and surveilling activist groups and critics of law enforcement. One of the most concerning proposals in the Border Security Workgroup documents would create a similar structure, but ostensibly for identifying and deporting immigrants. This proposed system would be under the direct command of Donald Trump and would, of course, lead to similar or worse consequences. The Border Security Workgroup recommendations revolved around one central line of operation: to dramatically restructure and militarize domestic law enforcement through the course of this year. If enacted, this proposal would constitute the most drastic restructuring of American law enforcement since 9/11. The post-9/11 restructuring created a system of law enforcement and intelligence fusion centers nationwide. It also created the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, ODNI, and the Department of Homeland Security, which assumed command of such entities as Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Customs and Border Protection. Fusion centers, as they exist today, integrate the efforts of state and local law enforcement with DHS and other federal agencies such as the FBI. While the current fusion center system does investigate and interdict crimes committed by transnational criminal organizations, such as Tren de Aragua, local law enforcement, for the most part, does not engage in matters of federal immigration law enforcement. The internal Project 2025 documents obtained by CRN and New Times propose creating a wholly new fusion center-style system. This new law enforcement infrastructure, they say, would incorporate four tiers of command. Regional command, to integrate local sheriffs, municipal police, state troopers, game wardens, etc. State command, to oversee and support all regional command units within each state. District command, to oversee, support, and coordinate actions of state command units within geographical districts throughout the nation. And headquarters command, to direct it all. To facilitate the administration's mass deportation goals, several proposals in the Border Security Workgroup materials would expand the use of programs that extend federal immigration enforcement powers to local law enforcement officers. For example, documents contemplate waiving 287G training requirements for sheriff's deputies and municipal police working in regional command units. The 287G program allows local law enforcement to work in concert with ICE in such matters as immigration raids. Per the internal Project 2025 documents, Headquarters Command is to be directed by a Commander of Domestic Security Operations, who will be appointed by the President of the United States and take direction on how to conduct operations in a manner decided by the President. Headquarters Command would also contain a multi-jurisdictional law enforcement liaison group, which would consist of representatives from all levels of the integrated law enforcement command structure, from county officials to the FBI, the DHS, the IRS, and others. Headquarters Command would also be the level at which the military melds with local law enforcement to provide operational support. Documents we've obtained discuss potential workarounds to laws that prohibit most military engagement in matters of domestic law enforcement. Furthermore, the documents recommended mobilization of up to 1 million troops to aid in proposed domestic security operations and identified specific military air bases to be used for rapid deportation flights. Documents also show the group crafted presidential actions directing military support to civilian law enforcement and contemplated invoking the Insurrection Act, which would allow for active military participation in domestic law enforcement. These recommendations were not made by your average wingnut. In fact, many of these wingnuts at one point likely held security clearance. CRN and New Times review of these documents and associated metadata shows that at least half of those involved in the Project 2025 Border Security Workgroup were career, high-level military and intelligence personnel. The documents lay out timelines and several lines of operation for accomplishing this domestic law enforcement restructuring by the end of this year. Propaganda, immigrants as terrorists. Already this year, Americans have watched the spectacle of the Trump administration's immigrant crackdown. The administration has posted videos of shackled immigrants being loaded onto deportation flights and photo ops at El Salvador's infamous CECOT prison, where the Trump administration has sent supposed Venezuelan gang members. These actions fit a proposed communication strategy contained in the Border Security Workgroup documents. The intent? To bolster political support and gain stakeholder buy-in for the central effort to overhaul and militarize domestic law enforcement. A strategic communications timeline in the documents suggests propaganda for selling the country on the law enforcement restructuring and militarization plans. A section detailing pre-election communication strategy reads, "Our law enforcement agencies can help save so many victims, Americans and the illegal aliens held captive, indentured, and trafficked here. We must find and capture any potential terrorists or malign actors as a priority." Documents explicitly state that the target audience for this messaging is the American public. Recommended communications for the pre-inauguration period encouraged interagency cooperation and assistance among all levels of law enforcement and included the following messaging intended for the American public and opposition politicians. "Our fine Border Patrol agents and immigration officials can do this job and will be asking Congress to provide them with the necessary tools and resources. Together, we can stop the trafficking, the misery, and the murder." Last, the messaging strategy timeline carries us through the first 100 days of the Trump presidency by driving home the terrorist threat. "Coordination, coordination, coordination. We ask all state and local authorities to help the U.S. find the dangerous terrorists and remove criminals from preying on the public. Audience, American public, state and local politicians. Counterintelligence and the insider threat. Over time, the post-9/11 Fusion Center system turned on the American people in ways the general public did not anticipate. By contrast, the new militarized law enforcement structure contemplated in the Project 2025 Border Security Workgroup documents has civil rights ramifications built into its DNA. A significant portion of the documents discussed domestic counterintelligence. The draft proposals contained recommendations to investigate, prosecute, and even seize the assets of non-governmental organizations, along with state, municipal, and federal agencies that provide services to immigrants and refugees. Documents describe some NGOs and specific government agencies as potential targets because they are perceived to oppose the priorities of the president and because they are accomplices to immigration crime. Already, surrogates of the president have suggested prosecuting people, including lawmakers, who distribute Know Your Rights material or post about the whereabouts of ICE officers. Laying the groundwork. Through the first 100 days of his term, Trump issued a number of executive orders that seem intent on bringing the Border Security Workgroup's recommendations to fruition. That has caught the eye of Jessica Pishko, an attorney and journalist who has written a book on the far-right radicalization of American law enforcement. Though she is not privy to the documents obtained by CRN and New Times, she has noticed an emergent pattern in Trump's executive orders. The biggest concern I have is that if Trump decides to bring all of local law enforcement under his purview and use it to conduct mass deportations and/or mass surveillance of certain groups of people, that it would be very easy to do that. He would have a lot of manpower, Pishko said. Right now, it's immigrants. It could change things, and it could switch pretty quickly to other groups. It could switch to protesters. It could switch to academics. It could switch to journalists. The Project 2025 Border Security Workgroup documents obtained by CRN and the New Times detail the creation of this new militarized law enforcement structure nationwide through the course of this year. They lay out many of the steps that so concern Pishko. Crafted in secret, their recommendations are seemingly becoming reality with every passing week. And if the documents are to be believed, many more alarming developments are to come. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for additional interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawkrock.